Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by Discovering God's Future for Your Church. This turnkey video toolkit helps your congregation discern and implement God's vision for your church's next faithful steps. Discovering God's Future for Your Church is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/shop. Why is change so difficult for churches? In this episode, we speak with Scott Cormode about how church leaders can break free of common myths that cloud our thinking about change, and also how to embrace processes that sow the seeds of meaningful innovation.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I am Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center, and your host for this talk. Joining me is Dr. Scott Cormode, Hugh Dupree Professor of Leadership Development at Fuller Theological Seminary. He's the author of The Innovative Church, How Leaders and Their Congregations Can Adapt in an Ever-Changing World. Our focus for this podcast is recalibrating the church. Scott, I'm so happy that you're with us and talking about your new book, which is well done. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you. I've always had a lot of connection with the Lewis Center, especially back when Lovett Weems was the director. And so I'm pleased to be able to work with you.
Thank you. Let us get right into this excellent book that I highly recommend to our audience. And I want to ask, could you briefly share with listeners the premise of your book, The Innovative Church?
So the book starts out with one idea. It's this, that the church as we know it is calibrated for a world that no longer exists. We have designed church so that we want to accomplish things, to solve problems for a world that is no longer the way that we think it is. Now, this book was written before the COVID world, but it's very easy for us to see that the church is designed for a world that no longer exists. And so we're going to have to respond with innovation. But there's a catch. If you read there's just this enormous amount of literature on innovation. We know an awful lot about innovation. But one of the basic understandings, premise of the idea of innovation is that we need to abandon the past. They call it burning the boats. The problem with that, of course, is that we will never abandon the past. We will never stop reading 2 Corinthians. We're never going to stop saying Jesus is Lord. We're never going to stop loving our neighbor as ourselves. So that creates for us, we who are Christians, a really interesting problem. And that is, how do we innovate our way forward without abandoning the past? And the book then is designed around this question. How do we maintain a rock-solid commitment to the unchanging Christian gospel while at the same time create an innovative or entrepreneurial spirit for how to present that gospel to an ever-changing culture? In other words, an unchanging gospel for an ever-changing culture. And so that's the question that we take up.
Scott, thank you for sort of outlining that. And I was intrigued by your question, and I think that you're right on target. I'm curious, do you believe that anyone else besides the church has sort of faced this challenge where you really can't give up the past completely, but at the same time, you have to innovate? Or is this challenge really unique to the church?
Well, I think this is actually at the heart of many of the political debates that we have right now. American democracy is built on the idea that we have a constitution that was written in 1787, yet at the same time, it is alive and well today. And how do we then figure out how to reinvent our future without abandoning our past? And many, many, many of the debates that we encounter on either side of the aisle are about trying to figure out how do we maintain solidarity with the past while innovating our way forward. And so we are not the only one, but anyone who has created any organization, any part of society that has created something that is supposed to be the fulfillment of something that lasts, anything that really lasts beyond many, many generations faces this problem.
Thank you. That was a good insight. And I agree with you. The political arena, which of course is very hot now, is a sort of an excellent analogy. I want to continue into the book, and you make a comment for our readers, of course, who haven't read it yet, they'll come across this, where you say, wait and copy strategy will no longer work. Can you share with the readers what you mean by sort of the wait and copy strategy, and why do you believe it will not work?
Sure. For generations, hundreds of years, really you could argue for thousands of years, the strategy of the church has been that when something massive happens in society and things change, most churches don't really change. They just wait. And then some pioneers figure out how to respond to that change. And then over the course of many years, everybody else adopts that change and it becomes the standard way to move forward. And that works great if you're looking at how do we respond to some massive change like the Industrial Revolution, something that happens that radically changes society once a century. But the scholars that have been studying this will tell you that what once happened once a century eventually started happening once a generation, and then more often. And now they would argue that we were experiencing some kind of generational change every 7 to 8 years. I could point to half a dozen different examples. Probably the best book on this is the columnist Thomas Friedman from the New York Times wrote a wonderful book called Thank You for Being Late, where he documents in the second chapter how society has changed so quickly that we no longer have time to wait. That if we take the time to wait to copy other people, by the time that we have copied the people that figured it out, a new change has been upon us. It's almost like, have you ever seen waves coming in on shore? They come in kind of a rhythm. But the image that I have now is that we're no longer on waves of a shore, but it's like shooting the rapids of a river that has gone wild. The waves are coming in all sorts of different directions. Social change is happening so quickly that we live in what one scholar has come to call a world of permanent whitewater. And so the wait and copy strategy will no longer work. And so what churches need to adopt is a skill set that allows them to be agile. So the ability to be agile or agility is the number one predictor of whether or not you can thrive into the future, because the wait and copy strategy can no longer work.
And as you talk about leadership, and of course, a lot of this has to do with leaders who are the ones who sort of have bought into the wait and copy strategy. It's not solely on the leader. You comment that the work of Christian leadership is planting and watering. And I think you're right on target for several reasons. And of course, this is a image that comes directly out of the Bible. But I'm curious, because I'm sure you've heard many individuals say, as I've heard them say, that I've spent a life of planting and watering, but nothing's happened. How would you respond to those individuals, given that you see this as a key image for Christian leadership?
You're asking a great question. So let me explain what I mean by planting and watering. And then I'll explain to you how I would respond to the person that spends a lifetime on that. In 1 Corinthians 3:6, it talks about Paul planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. And what's important about that is the work that God does, not the work that Paul and Apollos do. Paul and Apollos do important work, but it's not the crucial thing. The crucial thing is God gave the increase. And I argue that the book that I'm writing is a book about planting and watering. And my image of planting and watering is shaped by the fact that my grandfather was what the Bible would call a steward. He was the one who managed a 140-acre citrus ranch for an absentee landlord, so a steward. And he spent all of his days trying to create an environment where his trees would grow, but he could not make them grow. He could make sure they got enough water. He could manage the the soil. He could manage the trying to make sure the temperature did not. That's one of the things in Southern California they work a lot on is what they call smudge pots or wind machines, trying to make sure it doesn't get that things don't get frozen. All of that stuff he could do, but he couldn't make anything grow. Only God can give the increase. And that is exactly the situation that we find ourselves in. We know if we don't plant and water, nothing will grow. But we have no guarantees. I had a student once who was the president of a ball bearing factory. He had guarantees. He knew he had a machine that if he put the right raw materials into the machine, at the very end, he would get ball bearings that would look exactly like he wanted them to. And if they didn't, he would stop the machine. He would fix the machine until he could get a guaranteed outcome. We in the church do not have a mechanism that can get a guaranteed outcome. We are like my grandfather. We plant and then we water and then we turn our people over to God. So now to your question about what about the people that spend a lifetime and say they don't have anything to show for it. All God asks for us to be is faithful. God does not ask us to produce something. So there were times when my grandfather would do all the right things, but citrus trees are very vulnerable. The fruit that we have starts out as little tiny blossoms, little tiny flowers. And if the winds happen to come on just as the flowers are on the trees, they would blow the blossoms off and then nothing would come. The blossoms couldn't turn into fruit. And so there would be almost no harvest that year. My grandfather could do everything right and then not have much of a harvest because the winds came at the wrong time. In the same way, all God can ask us to do is to plant into water, to be faithful, and then God gives the increase. Sometimes that increase is far more than we expect or deserve, and sometimes that increase is not. Any of us who's ever preached know that there's times when I preached a sermon and I thought, this is just not my best, and I'm kind of a little embarrassed by it. And yet somehow through all of that, God creates wonderful growth. And there have been times I've preached a sermon where I just thought I knocked it out of the park and nothing seemed to happen from it. I plant, I water, and God gives the increase.
Thank you. That was very helpful, and I love the analogy. And of course, you also use it in the book, and I think it's a helpful analogy. I think it's still going to be tremendously hard, as you know, for many pastors to sort to live into what you are suggesting, just because there's so much pressure from denominations, and even if you're not in a denomination, there's still a lot of pressure. So it's really working on, as you say, remembering what God has called us to versus what our particular denomination has called us to do.
Can I say something about
that? Oh, yeah, please do.
Because one of the things that I think about is my grandfather. My grandfather lived in a time, he farmed in the 40s and 50s, and it was a time of tremendous technological change in the farming community. And he had an obligation that although he wasn't an educated man, he spent an enormous amount of time learning about the various technologies, what made possible different changes. And in the same way, we who lead God's people bear an obligation to continue learning, to continue planting and watering in the ways that make the most sense. And there are those sometimes who hear me say that you plant and water and then you hand it over to God and it almost sounds passive. Now, planting and watering is a tremendously active and proactive kind of work. We bear an enormous responsibility, but we have to do it in the same way that we pray. We pray and then we hand our people over to God, and only God can take the action that matters most. And that's the world that we live in.
Excellent. I appreciate it, and I think the listeners will appreciate it too, particularly being reminded that they have a particular role, but it still is dependent upon God. I want to pick up a little bit off of a point you make related to Heifetz, who you talk about, and the sort of claim they make about people resisting loss. It's not that people are opposed to change, but they resist loss. And I think we all share that Heifetz is on to something when he talks about this. You sort of play with that as you work out this idea of yours of mental models and how within congregations that the challenge is helping people to really create a different mental model. Can you share with our listeners what you mean by mental models, and then how, once you sort of understand that, that you can actually help people to move towards change?
Sure. A mental model is the image that we have in our head of how things should be. So if I ask you, what's your mental model of a car? You're going to probably talk about something that has a steering wheel or four wheels or a windshield. And if I show you something that has no steering wheel and no windshield and no four wheels, you'd say, I don't know what that thing is, but it's not a car. It doesn't fit your mental model. That's an easy example. What about your mental model of a preacher? I talk to my students about what their mental model of a preacher is. And for some of them, it is a man. It's standing on a raised platform with a Hawaiian shirt on and a big black Bible in his left hand, pointing to verse by verse as he talks about the scripture. And that's certainly a way that some people have preached, but that's their image of how preaching should be. And then when they see some other kind of preaching, they go, I don't know what that thing is, but it looks as strange as a car that doesn't have four wheels. We have these kinds of mental models. Well, I do a lot of work with the Fuller Youth Institute. And one of the things that we talk about is how people have mental models of how youth ministry should be. So just like my grandfather in the 40s and 50s and 60s learned that things change over time, our image of how youth ministry should be has changed over time. I was working with a congregation not that long ago where they went back to the youth ministry, went back to their congregation and said that we're going to be doing youth ministry a little bit different. We've learned some things. And the pastor was offended. He said, wait a second. 20 years ago, I was a youth minister, and this is what worked for me. And we don't need to do anything any different than what worked for me in the 1970s or 1980s or whatever it was. And the world has changed. But he was calibrated for a world that no longer existed. And so his mental model of what could work and what should work, well, it was off because he was measuring it against young people who probably didn't have smartphones in their pocket and their lives dominated by social media, just to give an example of what it wasn't like 20, 30 years ago. So you ask a question about people don't resist change, they resist loss. It's a statement about why change is hard. Now, there's some changes that are really easy. If I came to you and I said, Douglas, I'm here from the Internal Revenue Service. I'm here to apologize. We've made a terrible mistake. We owe you $10,000. Here's a check.
I'm still waiting on that day, I want you to know.
Yeah. But you would not resist that change.
I would not.
But if at the same time I say I'm from the Internal Revenue Service, we've made a terrible mistake, you owe us $10,000, you would resist that change. People are not resistant to change. They are resistant to the kinds of change that cause them to experience loss. So when we encounter mental models, new mental models, one of the ways that we can help people change is by inviting them into new mental models. But oftentimes people will resist that because it forces them to acknowledge the ways the world has changed in ways that they don't necessarily want to face. And so they often live in denial until we get to the point where we help them see that their mental model of the world just doesn't keep up with the world that as it has changed. That the world has changed and that they have an old view of the world. And that becomes very difficult for a lot of congregations.
Thank you. That's helpful. And I really appreciated the sort of image of the mental model. I think it will be a help to pastors to think of it in that way. And you provide some ideas for how to sort of help people to play with mental models that can not guarantee change, but at least hopefully help them to move in the right direction. I want to... shift a little bit, and you talk about a lot about innovation, as you said earlier. But in relationship to this, you talk about sort of the myth of the redwood tree. And you talk about it in a relationship to sort of misconceptions about innovation. Can you sort of draw that analogy out for our listeners and why it's important as it relates to the church?
Sure. So that same grandparent, my same grandparent, when they retired from the ranch, they bought the only house they ever owned. It was a tiny 1,000 square foot house with a dozen citrus trees off to the side. It was really much more of an orchard with a little house attached to it. But what was strange about it is they had, you know, the world's tiniest backyard. But in that backyard was a giant redwood tree. Now, how did that redwood tree get to be in the middle of a valley that had not, you know, there's no redwood trees for hundreds of miles? What happened? Well, there's a story, obviously. They bought the house from a guy named Lester. And in the 1920s, when Lester went up to the redwoods and he saw a little sapling there. And so he dug it up and put it in a little can and took it home and planted it in his yard. And, you know, he nurtured it a little bit and it barely made it. And for many, many years, it was this scrawny little thing. But then eventually it hit the water table. And when it hit the water table, it shot up and is now the tallest tree in the valley in the backyard of this, you know, little suburban home. Well, the image that most people have of innovation is that redwood tree. And I'm going to tell you the image is wrong. But what they think of is that innovation happens when one singular person sees something that other people don't see. And they plant this little seed and they have to nurture it because it's so difficult and it goes through some many, many hard times, but then eventually it takes off and becomes to dominate the landscape. And it's this idea of the myths of that are three different myths. The myth of the single idea, the myth of the person working on their own, and the myth of the idea that innovation is isolated and singular. Innovation happens in community. We think of the stereotype of somebody like Thomas Edison, who had all these ideas. Well, Thomas Edison, actually, his biggest idea was he employed a bunch of people who were all working on different kinds of ideas, and he had a plan where they would have one idea a week, and of those ideas, one of them a month would be really good, and one of them a year would be transformative. And he employed just a ton of people doing that kind of thing. We think of him as the isolated genius, but his genius was for organizing others to do that kind of innovative work. So that's the first myth. But the other is the idea that innovation comes from one single idea. It turns out that the best innovations come from people who have lots of ideas. Matter of fact, Edison's famous for saying, if you want to have a good idea, have lots of them. So let me give you an example. There was a study done once of about a ceramics class. You know, this is a community college. They had 50 students in the class. And they turned to 25 on the left and they said, you're going to be judged at the end of the semester by the quality of your work and the whatever pot or other kind of ceramic you create. And they turn to the right side of the class and they say, you will be judged not by the quality, but by the amount of clay that you use, the quantity. And so the question is, at the end of the semester, who had the best quality? Because you would think that the people who worked on quality would, but it wasn't. The people who worked on quality would spend each week that they came to class meticulously kind of modifying or working on their one thing. The people who did quantity every week would try something new. How does experience play out? Well, experience turns out to be measured in cycles of attempts. So by the end of the semester, the people that were working on the quantity had created so many different pots, so many different things, that they were much more experienced and much better at ceramics and much better at making things from clay. So something that they made at the last minute was actually of higher quality than the one who'd been working all semester, because they had gone through many cycles of ideas. And what that teaches us is that quantity creates quality. If you want to have one good idea, try a whole bunch of things and then nurture the thing that works.
Thank you. And I want to, we don't have a lot of time left, but I have a couple more questions. But I want listeners to get a sense of sort of, as you have set up what innovation is not, you also then share with listeners some practices that can help them to think about innovation in a different way. And we don't have time, of course, to go through all of the practices that you suggest, but I'm going to put you in a spot. If you could pick one or two of your favorite practices to share with the listeners, and how that can help us to think differently about innovation and change, that would be fantastic. So I'll let you choose.
So one of them is experiment-driven learning. And like we were just talking about, if you want to have a good idea, have a bunch of them. But the key is trying experiments on the margins. We all have to recognize that every time you make an experiment, you're a rookie. You're trying something new. And we all know about rookies, that rookies make rookie mistakes. The problem with a lot of churches is they decide to try something new and then sign up to make their rookie mistakes in public. You know, so many churches that I know, when they want to try something new, what they do is they have a theme music and a logo, and they do all this kind of stuff, and they say, come watch us mess up. Because the first few times you try something, you're not going to be very good at it. The best churches, what they do is they try something on the side, and they keep working at it until they get to the point where they're good at it, and then they bring it into prime time. So the worship service is a terrible place to try something new. Try stuff new that's on the side all over the place. But the least forgiving place that you could try something is in the worship service. It's like signing up to say, come watch us make our rookie mistakes. Well, what'll happen is you'll make your rookie mistakes. People will say, well, you know, that didn't work out. We'll never try it again. One of my students likes to say that, you know, he's somebody that comes from the engineering world, and he talks about how, you know, he didn't get to the moon until Apollo 12. If Apollo 1, Apollo 3, Apollo 5 did whatever they were supposed to do, and somebody says, it didn't get to the moon, I guess we should stop the Apollo program, that doesn't make any sense. Everything we tried a number of things until eventually we had the moonshot. You got to build on the side with experiments, learn from those experiments, and then eventually bring it into prime time.
Thank you. And I will close with this question. And again, this comes back to the fact that pastors often struggle with the issue of metrics. And you point out metrics are important. But the key is we need to make sure that we are using the right metrics. How do we help leaders move away from things like attendance to measuring things like where we're headed in the future, things that are important in terms of what it means for actual innovation and helping us stay grounded sort of in our tradition?
So let's go back to the image of planting and watering. My grandfather didn't just measure how much fruit he produced. He spent most of his days measuring the water and measuring, you know, all the things that would be creating an environment for growth. So what are the things that are the environment for innovation, the environment for growth that we can measure? One of the things that the book talks about is leadership begins with listening. That the purpose of listening is to listen so that the listener will be transformed by empathy. If I can be transformed by empathy, it will change the way that I relate to people. And we spent a lot of time in the book talking about how to listen, or who to listen to, what to listen for, and how to listen well. Well, what gets measured gets done. If you want to do innovation, one of the things that I teach congregations to do is measure the amount of listening you do. And so we work with congregations where we say, okay, you've got a small little pastoral staff of three or four people. Every week when you come together, ask three questions. Who did you listen to this week? What did you learn? And who will you listen to next week? And if you do that again and again, you are measuring the kinds of things that will eventually create innovation. Just like measuring the amount of water that goes into trees. But just watering trees is not enough. But if you don't water them well, they're not going to grow. In the same way, if you don't spend time listening to your people, that, well, if you listen to them, that's a great thing, but it can't guarantee growth. But if you want to guarantee you won't grow, don't listen. So listening is a way of measuring the ability to plant and water towards innovation.
Scott, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. This has been fantastic. And I'll say again to the readers, this is one of those books that will alter the way you think about and engage in ministry. The Innovative Church, How Leaders and Their Congregations Can Adapt in an Ever-Changing World. Make sure that you pick it up and read it.
On the next Leading Ideas Talks, David Petty and Russell Dornish share how they created a community committed to playing video games and sharing conversations about faith.
The stigma around video games is huge. And so part of what we've aimed to do with this group is to really destigmatize video games, video gamers. For some reason, we often hear the anecdotes in society of, you know, if you're a gamer, then live in your parents' basement because you don't have a job. And, you know, which in and of itself is a whole other stigma with, you know, why don't you fit in with this notion of society and capitalism that we adhere to, but really trying to destigmatize that to say, look, if you're a video gamer, like you're just a human being, you're a beloved child of God. Also destigmatizing and having those conversations about like violence in video games. You know, people often think, well, violent video games lead to violence in real life. But what we find if you actually look at so many of the studies is that that's not the case.
Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to our weekly newsletter, Leading Ideas, at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.